Let's talk about different types of mutual funds. When a mutual fund is diversified, it could be diversified along several different types of criteria. In other words, they could have diversification among industries. We have some pharmaceutical companies, we have some automotive companies, we have some telecommunications companies. That way, when one sector goes into a slowdown, it doesn't take down the whole fund. Or even if we were within the same sector or industry space, we would probably have a variety of different securities issuers. You don't want all Walmart. You might want some Kohl's, and you might want some Target in your portfolio so that if one company goes into a slump, it doesn't take down the whole portfolio. And then as we can see from the outline, types of investment instruments. If we're a bond fund, they don't all have to be 10-year bonds. You know, they can also put some money in T-bills, and they can put some money in Ginnie Mae's, which are mortgage-backed securities. Now, when we look at this catalog for all of the mutual fund holdings this fund family has, you can see that they put the growth category as the highest risk, and they even put it in red for their little color-coded system. Well, a growth fund just means that they're trying to buy stocks in companies who are expected to grow faster than others or faster than the general market, but we do take on a lot more risk here. When you buy a growth stock, you pay a high price-to-earnings ratio. You pay a lot for any earnings the company may or may not even have yet. Well, you could be aggressive growth or more conservative growth, but either way, you're in the growth category. Aggressive growth would involve buying stocks in companies that haven't matured yet. Maybe their industry is still in the startup phase. So we're putting a lot of faith in our speculation here when we use aggressive growth strategies. Emerging markets would be an aggressive growth strategy. You're buying stock in companies in China. Well, that political system is still a little bit hard to predict. And if there's another communist revolution, the shares of stock you bought in those so-called private companies aren't going to be worth the paper they're printed on. So aggressive growth, and you can have conservative growth. But either way, growth, we're not looking for regular dividend checks. We're just looking for the capital appreciation, the share price to go up. We could also buy equity income funds, which are obviously looking for consistent dividends. And what if your investor wants some growth and income? We could get really clever and put her into a growth and income fund. Some of the stocks are purchased for growth. Some of the others are purchased for their consistent dividend payment. And you can see the growth is the highest risk here. Then growth and income, because we still have that growth component. And then pure equity income. Now, we talked about growth stocks, where I buy companies who are trading at pretty high multiples, high price-to-earnings ratios. Some funds like to buy stocks and companies that are suffering a setback, and their share price is very low right now, but they see it as a value opportunity, and we call this a value fund. So companies who put together growth and value indexes would tell you what the criteria is, but it would be based on the price-to-earnings ratio. Maybe they'll tell you that any price-to-earnings ratio at 20 or above, that's in our growth index. Anything below that is in our value index. So understand that a value fund buys stocks and companies who are currently facing a setback, but they're probably established companies who are, we think anyway, likely to turn it all around. Okay. So do you have to buy a growth fund as opposed to a value fund? Well, you can see this next item is a blended fund, which means they could actually mix a few investment styles there. So we buy some growth stocks, we also buy some value, and we blend it together. What is a balanced fund? That's a percentage of bonds and stock. So if somebody wants to, instead of buying a separate bond and stock fund, if they want to do it together, we can sell them a balanced fund. Okay. And there's no rigid percentage. Each prospectus would tell you the approximate, 75-25 or 60-40 mix. That's up to the advisor and to some extent the board of directors too. Well, those are equity funds. We move into a lower volatility category when we get to fixed income. And some of these are taxable and some aren't. Well, that just means that if you buy a government bond fund, that's taxable at the federal level only. If you buy a tax-exempt fund, which is a municipal bond fund, you don't pay tax to the federal government, but you might pay tax to the states. Depends on where you live. And that's why this company has a Maryland and a Virginia fund. That would be attractive to residents of those high-tax states of Maryland and Virginia. Not only are the dividend payments going to be exempt from federal, but also state taxes there. Because remember, if you live in Alabama and you buy a bond issued outside your state, even though the federal government won't tax this muni bond interest, the state of Alabama could. Okay, so if you live in Tuscaloosa and you buy a bond issued by Tupelo, Mississippi, well, it is a muni bond, so federal government gives you a break, but the state of Alabama and the local government of Tuscaloosa could tax that. Money market, sometimes they call these stable value. They don't guarantee it, but they basically maintain the share price at a dollar and you make some interest. So this would be for somebody who's just parking her money for maybe 5 or 6 months while she buys a house, or she needs to get very dependable income every month for her mother's nursing home expenses. The money market would make sense there. There are also specialized funds. So we're back to equity funds, and see, the outline doesn't quite work like an outline. Oh, well. Under equity funds, we could specialize. And instead of just talking about growth or value, we could be the pharmaceutical fund or the internet e-commerce fund. Maybe some of you made and lost some money in that. Understand that industry specialization, which is a specialized fund, that's going to take on a little bit more risk, because if you're in the telecommunications sector, when that thing slows down, the fund goes down with it. So higher risk reward when you start to specialize. And we could also have geographic concentrations, the Pacific Rim Fund or the Europe Fund or the Asia Fund. That's pretty much telling you where the concentration is going there. Asset allocation just means this fund will keep a percentage in equity, a percentage in fixed income, and a percentage in the money market. There's also something here, fund of funds. As I said, you have to be a high net worth individual to buy a hedge fund per se, but you could buy a little slice of that through the fund of funds. So this is for usually a minimum investment of $25,000, but you have to have your lockup period. You're not going to be able to sell or redeem these for a while, because that's how hedge funds work. So you have to explain to your customer there's a little bit more risk here in a fund of funds, but if you really, really want to participate in hedge funds and don't have the net worth requirements, you can buy shares of a fund of funds. And if you want your principal protected, we can sell you a principal protected fund. In other words, the mutual fund will guarantee that your principal will be protected, but you have to wait several years for that to kick in. So in other words, you're going to be in the principal protected fund for a while, but they do guarantee that what you put in, your account balance will reflect that principal as of a certain number of years, usually 5 years. Well, we can't cover everything, because that would take pretty much 6 hours, and we don't want to make this a box set of CDs. And also, you guys would probably like to go home sometime today too. But you can see they talk about the structure and operation. Well, this is pretty well laid out right here in the outline. There's a board of directors who establishes investment policy, and they oversee the investment advisor and basically everybody else. They set the policies for when dividends and capital gains will be distributed. They give a contract to the investment advisor. That's the party who manages the portfolio and gives investment advice. As we said, the shareholders get to vote for both the board and approve that contract. If we have an underwriter, that means somebody's bearing all those distribution costs. Well, they're the wholesaler, the distributor, the underwriter. They go around selling directly to investors, or more likely they probably go through a network of broker-dealers. And then these guys are all compensated from that sales charge. We need a custodian to safeguard the physical assets of the fund. And as it says, they do payable and receivable functions. So when the investment advisor buys $1 million of GE, the custodian has to release that money. The custodian would also be receiving the dividend checks from GE or anybody else. And a transfer agent, they have to issue the shares, either physical shares or more likely book entry. They have to cancel the redeem shares, so they're constantly doing the records of who owns how many shares at this point. Now, the custodian would receive the dividend from GE. Who pays the dividend to the investor? That would be the transfer agent. And this mutual fund here on the back, they have an 800 number. That's for their transfer agent. They call it shareholder services. That's what the transfer agent performs. As we said, you get to vote. Laid that out. No reason to do it again. And also understand that you have to go through a real mutual fund prospectus yourself, I think, to prepare, so that you can look at these total return figures. What are these bar charts signifying? Well, it's all the good stuff. You take the growth in NAV, you add the dividend and the capital gain distributed to the investor, and then you compare that to where the NAV started. That's a total return. So if the question says the NAV was 10 at the beginning of the year, it finished at 11, the fund paid a dollar in dividends and a dollar in capital gains, you would add all three of those items, a dollar in cap appreciation, a dollar in dividends, a dollar in capital gains. We went up 3 outa compared to 10. That's a 30% total return. Of course, you can see this is a small cap fund, and we've had years as high as 61% in a positive direction, but that was also followed up by a minus 15, a minus 17, and a minus 22, a lot more volatility. In any case, that is total return. It reflects compounding. If you were in through for the whole year and you reinvested your dividends and capital gains, you would have had a total return of 30%. Now, yield is just the dividend divided by the share price, but total return has cap appreciation, capital gains paid out, and dividends paid out as well. All right, let's also take a look at taxation, because that's a big focus of the Series 6, obviously. And what I want to talk to you about now is dividends and capital gains distributions. All right, what's going on here? Well, a mutual fund holds many stocks, and even if they're aggressive growth, they put some money in fixed income, so they're getting some interest. The dividends and the interest that they receive, that's how they cover their expenses: board of directors, transfer agent, custodian, 12b1 fees, all that stuff that gets deducted out of assets. Well, it's going to get deducted out of this, really. So let's say the fund earned $1 million in dividends and they earned $500,000 in interest. That's their gross income. They use that to pay their expenses. Maybe their expenses were $500,000. Well, if we add and subtract this, D plus I minus E, DI, we would see that on net, they have net income of $1 million. Well, they might not want to pay taxes on their net income, or at least not on all of it, so they can qualify for what we call the conduit tax treatment. They just send at least 90% of that $1 million directly to the shareholders, and then the fund only gets taxed on the remaining 10, and they can send out more, but it has to be at least 90%. Now, when you and I receive these dividends, we're going to pay tax on them. In other words, whatever the fund distributes, they don't pay tax, and we do, okay? So you get this little handy 1099, and it tells you maybe $500 in qualified dividends and $100 in ordinary dividends. Remember that qualified dividends maximum tax now is 15%, but if it says it's an ordinary dividend, you're paying your ordinary income rate on that. So now you can see why expense ratios do matter. You know, all of that board of director, 12b1, custodian, transfer agent, all of that added up compared to the average net assets would be the expense ratio. That's the E in our D plus I minus E. So the higher those expenses are, the less money there is for us to receive. Now, if the husband decides to spend that dividend distribution and the wife reinvests into more shares, she will get to buy more shares at the net asset value, avoiding the sales charge. But the IRS, who is here to help, could care less. They're both going to pay tax on the dividends. So when she reinvests her dividends, that will add to her cost basis, and she'll have to keep track of that. Someday she's going to sell these shares. What's her cost basis? Whatever she originally paid, plus all of the reinvestments. But it has no effect on the taxation. Okay, you get taxed on the dividend, whether it's distributed to you and you cash the check, or you're reinvested into more shares. Capital gains are a little tricky. At the end of the year, the fund manager is going to sell some shares of stock for more than she bought them. Actually, she's going to do that all throughout the year. At the end of the year, she's going to total it all up. If she ends up with more gains than losses, they have a net capital gain, and they distribute that to the investors, usually once a year at the end of the year. There's really nothing you can do about it as a shareholder. Here's your share of the capital gains we took by trading the fund throughout the year. How often does the fund trade? That's the turnover ratio. Well, the more they trade, the more capital gains they probably have. But here's the trick question. It'll say Joanne's been in the fund for 3 months and she receives a capital gains distribution. Is it short-term or long-term? Believe it or not, it's still probably long-term. Remember, it's the fund who held those shares before they sold them, so they usually make sure they hold it for more than a year to keep your tax burden down. But it had nothing to do with Joanne. She's just in the fund. She didn't sell anything. Okay, remember that. All right, so you can reinvest your capital gains at the net asset value, but the IRS still considers it a capital gain. Now, the other type of capital gain is when the fund holder sells her shares. Well, now, how long did you hold them, Joanne? If you held them for less than a year, you pay a much higher tax rate. If she held them for more than a year, it drops to her capital gains rate, which now is a maximum 15. So when she's getting a distribution, she had no control over it. The holding period is determined at the fund level. But when she sells her own shares, well, now it's how long did you hold it? 3 months. That's a short-term capital gain. If the test talks about unrealized gains, that just means that the value of the assets are going up. You don't pay taxes on unrealized gains. If you buy a fund for $10 and it goes to $15, there's no tax bill. There's only a tax bill, you know, once you sell it. I think we've covered the basics. If I really wanted to cover mutual funds in detail, this would end up being about 5 discs right there, so we can't really do that. But make sure you read a few prospectuses, you know what's in there and what isn't. Make sure you understand that the registered rep never highlights or alters a prospectus, and he doesn't provide his own little written summary, and he doesn't tell a customer to ignore any part of it. When is it delivered? Either at or before the solicitation. So you send it to somebody before you meet with them, or you hand it to them right when you sit down with them. Mutual funds do report to shareholders twice a year. In other words, semi-annual report and annual, the annual report must be audited. Well, there are other details which you'll get in the book Past the Six, and if you have any questions, please send me an email or give me a phone call.